way things turned out, it was better for me, I figured, to switch over. The transistor had been invented in 1948 on Bratton, and Bardeen put the first points down on germanium crystal. And that made everyone close to the project knew this was going to be a tremendous thing. So I had the opportunity to go into this, not as a chemist, a solid-state chemist. And I was familiar, of course, having had a lot of physics, with the some of the things going on, but I didn't know solid-state theory very well at all. So I had to educate myself, re-educate myself completely on solid-state chemistry and solid-state physics. Shockley being the one who was developing an awful lot of this theory, and Bardeen, and of course the British had come up with all sorts of background theory which applied to semiconductors in their work on metals. The band theory of metals was well established at that time by Martin Gurney and Cottrell and people like that. And so the semiconductors, which are similar to metals in their band structure, were the kind that were amenable to this same kind of theory. So I boned up on the theory as well as I could and undertook experimental work too, relating to surface properties, effective surface properties on germanium, and got two effects interested me there. One were the surface properties of germanium as it affected the electrical behavior of the material, the crystals that were being grown. And we had very pure crystals of germanium to work on at that time. And also an effect in germanium, which was a very curious thing that nobody seemed to understand, called the thermal conversion. And this was a sort of a fascinating a puzzle to me, and so I spent some time thinking about it and investigating it, and found out that it had to do with the way people were treating this material when they etched it and washed it. You could, if you took very great pains to make pure water, pure conductivity type water, even purer than conductivity type water, and looked for this effect, this thermal effect, in the germanium crystal, you wouldn't, it did not happen if you were good enough to get extremely pure conditions of preparation. It was so sensitive that if you went into a laboratory and grabbed a doorknob and happened to get any water on your hands that would be contaminated in this purified water, just touching it or anything of the sort, the effect would happen. Well, we spent a fair amount of time, I and some of the other chemists, J.D. Struthers, who was a radio chemist, working on this thing, and I showed that there was something in the ordinary water supply which was doing this, and that it was likely to be copper. We had eliminated iron and a number of other things, but copper seemed to be the main agent. Well, obviously, if this was affecting it, it was from the surface. And if it was from the surface, it was something that was getting into the crystal extremely fast when this was heated to above 500 degrees centigrade. So with the aid of radio tracers and that Struthers could provide, we did some experiments together and published a paper in which we proved that it was copper, that it was a very rapid diffusing agent into the crystal, and that it was creating acceptors, so-called acceptors in the crystal, and converting it from one type, N-type, to P-type. And so We then determined what the rate of diffusion was and the number of properties of the of this thing, and people were then aware of what might happen in the preparation of transistors and diodes, particularly was what I was interested in, if you heated the thing under contaminated conditions. Well, this led to other fast diffusing agents, and it led us into an examination of all diffusing, examining all diffusions. So we went into diffusion of the group 3 and the group 5 and published papers on this, and determined the diffusion coefficients of these active impurities in both germanium and silicon. And we found that lithium was an intermediate diffuser, not quite as rapid as copper, but much more rapid than boron and some of these other elements. And since these elements, active elements, of the group 3 being acceptors and the group 4 being, the group 5 rather, being donors in silicon and germanium, why, there was quite a lot of interest to everybody that was making transistors and diodes and electronic elements, devices out of silicon and germanium. So we had a tremendous demand for that reprint, and sent out, I don't know, many hundreds and hundreds of reprints. Not the biggest reprint we had was another one, but this one was second in demand, and the Japanese were particularly interested, as you can imagine. Some work on diffusion had been done by General Electric. We were not the original people to show that diffusion would lead to active areas, but they didn't apparently push it the way we did and determine the extent to which the various periodic elements would and the activation energies that were required to diffuse these things. So for a long time, and still to some extent, transistors are made this way, by diffusion, instead of, although the implantation, which is electrically driving these ions into the surface, has taken over mostly for this work. Still, diffusion is still used after all these years. But at first, we showed, for instance, too, that you could take a donor and acceptor and one diffusing faster than the other would overcome one in the race, and you could form a p-n junction that way by a so-called double diffusion. I think that was new. And that was very exciting work in the original, but I had the feeling that the laboratories was not really behind the work as fast as they should have been. I wrote, as a matter of fact, a letter to that effect up the line, but it apparently didn't stir anybody up very much. But eventually we, and the solar cell was really a side development on the whole business. It was not. It was something that developed on the side, because what we had here, you see, was not anything tremendous, except that by diffusion you could form large areas on the surface of different types of materials, very thin areas. And it was well known that the junction, the p-n junction between one active area, like an n area on a p area, would, under the influence of light, give rise to a voltage. And so it was maybe not obvious, but it was natural anyway, that you could produce a large area to collect sunlight, say, and derive electricity from it. And Pearson was aware of these facts. What he wasn't aware of was that at that time was that there were elements that were could be diffused into germanium and silicon, particularly silicon in this case, which would be permanently there under all conditions once you lowered the temperature, because they were slow, high-temperature diffusion elements. And he was enamored of things like, he knew about our lithium and our copper work, and he thought, well, they would work. But then he came to me and he said, look, what should we do about this thing? And I suggested we should use some of these slow diffusing agents, and we tried it, and with Chapin and examining these things, I found that we got order of magnitude more photoelectric effect than we got, than anybody had gotten out of previous selenium or other types of cells. So that caused quite a splash.
What year was that? When
that was 1954. And it caused such a splash because everybody knew about the sun, you know. The sun is a popular item. And I think it sort of overwhelmed the powers that be. We didn't want in the telephone company necessarily to get into this business. But it and we also, of course, wanted the transistor to be the prime thing, which it should be. And here comes this darn thing along, and the public grabs it and runs with it. So that, but of course, eventually the transistor did gain the place that it really deserved, which is probably the greatest invention in the 20th century. But we did go
was
through
there much additional development work on that solar battery, and what's
well, yes. After we left, we brought it to about 12% on small samples, and then it went to our development people, and they tried. They made some fairly good size pieces out of that. I think.
Watch the cord.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That is a cord. I had some junk in here. That's one of the original type cells there. And this is a higher voltage one, you see, where you can connect them in series like batteries and get a higher voltage. But the our development department push this thing farther, and I don't get much light. I think the connections here are poor. But with the yeah, there's a little there, but not very much. I'll have to watch that thing. They were able to get 10 or 15%, and since then, other people have been an awful lot of work put in this thing.
Oh yes.
Those are milliamps, of course, but that this has about a micron of diffused boron in it, a micron deep, and a very thin layer, you see, and then it makes contact to the center part, which is etched deep below that layer, and gets into the basic material. And then this outside part connects just with the layer. And so you have that as being the p-n junction. It's a broad area p-n junction, in fact. So that the thing was really overdone, probably, by people, especially our Department of Energy, who said they were going to derive all kinds of power from this, you know, power plants at something like $1,000 a kilowatt cost, and there's nothing of the kind. I mean, it's $10,000 or $15,000 a kilowatt might be possible, and I don't know why the DOE did that, why they made these projections, which were obviously faulty, but they never did reach that degree. Although there's some big installations, I have all of that books over there. All of those things over there refer to installations that were built and all kinds of clippings. I have a ton of clippings on this stuff, that houses, you know, with roofs on them. And we thought of a lot of these things, too, but we were never felt that it would compete with coal and nuclear power. Although it's great power for the desert where you need it,
yes,
and are willing to pay for it. It's great stuff.
I know somewhere that I think it was used in the early satellites, too.
Yeah, we were the first ones to put up a satellite, the Vanguard 1, I think, with a solar cell in it. And interestingly, the Russians came behind us about 5 months.
Really?
With one, yeah. Yeah. And there, of course, is where it was used successfully, and where the big development occurred was in the satellite program. It hadn't been to the satellites, why there wouldn't have been anywhere near the amount of money invested in it.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the amount of research money invested in looking for new and other alternative things would do the same kind of job as has been done on silicon has been quite sizable. And as yet, to my knowledge, has not yielded anything better than the silicon solar cell. Gallium arsenide is mentioned often, both as a photocell and as a substitute for silicon and transistors. And certainly it has the characteristics which will promote it for certain special jobs, and it will take over. We did a fair amount of looking at gallium arsenide, and it is a tough material to work with compared to silicon. Having two elements in it is twice as hard to work with as silicon is, but some of its properties, particularly the high mobility of the electrons in it, and its ability to withstand irradiation better than from the sun in space, makes it necessary for some applications. So we'll probably hear more and more about gallium arsenide as time goes on. It's been very slow in coming.
Yes, well, this has been, what, 30 years?
Yeah, that's 30-some years, yeah.
I wanted to ask you a little more about Chapin and Pearson. How did that relationship with them develop?
It was very interesting because people speak of teamwork, you know. Well, this had really none of the aspects of teamwork at all. I knew these fellows, but they're in totally different work.
Really?
Yeah, Pearson was he was active in much of the work in Shockley's group, which concerned transistors and diodes and other things, the physics of them. And I was in chemistry in a totally different building. I knew Pearson personally, but only to say hello to. And same with Chapin. He was working on power sources for telephone purposes in odd locations and things. And this, of course, was suggested for that purpose right away. But it never did really succeed in dominating that situation. So they were active in their own ways, and I was active in my own way. And if it hadn't been for Pearson coming to me, and also for the policy of the laboratory, which allows free access at all levels, you see. You don't have to go up there and ask this guy, am I going to be able to talk to this guy? You go right to that guy. And so if it hadn't been for Pearson coming to me and laying the problem out that he was concerned with, and I suggesting that he better do it this way, and Chapin examining these things, well, we never would have gotten together. So that it's, I suppose, an argument for organizing research in such a way that you do have free communication at all levels. And that is one of the great things, of course, about Bell Laboratories, that you can pick up a phone and call anybody you want, doesn't matter what level he's at, and talk to them. People won't talk to you. you have a connection.
I think we've covered that aspect pretty well, unless you have something else
to add with that. No, I think so.
I just wanted to go back, if I might, to the situation. We have covered it a little bit earlier. The situation you found when you came back from ORD. Things had changed at Bell Lab.
Yeah, as I say, there were these amalgamation going on among the materials people, people who are concerned with materials, and the chemical people who also deal with materials. And so there was, in our department, Williams had left as chemical director, and R.M. Burns had taken over that position. A number of, M.J. Kelly was the head of the laboratories, the chief executive officer, and J.R. Townsend was the head of the materials group in the other departments. So that there had to be an amalgamation of this kind, and which would involve applications work as well as research and sorting out of that kind. And I had the choice offered by a vice president by the name of Ralph Baum, who was a physicist by training and very nice guy, of either staying with that in that organization, a reorganization. And I was not, I must admit, on too good terms with the heads, or to be the head, or else going into the semiconductor work, which was developing rapidly, and which they wanted more people, especially chemists. And so I chose the latter and started over again, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to the polymer group after that?
The polymer group was taken over by, well, Baker took over when I went to, just after I came back. He was essentially in charge. I left him in charge for me, really, when I went away. And when I came back, he was still in that capacity, but in the reorganization, he was found himself in charge of polymer research. Some of the other people in my group were in charge of various applications groups, and they were pretty well broken up. I didn't follow this much further, but of course Baker was one of the fast rising stars at the laboratories, and had been, and I had always thought he was in my group, and wherever he went, everybody thought he was, and so he went sailing right up the top and became the chairman finally. So he started my group, but he ended up pretty high.
Did you keep in touch with him? You said you left him in charge when you went to R.D. Did you?
Oh, yeah. I would go back and visit the laboratories, of course, every few weeks, if I could do it.
Frequently.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or every, maybe not quite that frequently, but every 3 weeks, mm-hmm. sometimes sooner. See, I would go back to my home, which is my headquarters. I had my home as my base of operations in order that I could get my transportation paid by the government. If I'd made Washington my center of operations, where my office really was, I would have to pay my way home every time I went home and back again. Maybe that was a little crooked, but it was not illegal. And so I got home. Well, I had to go home occasionally. I got home every few weeks at least, and of course, the wife was very anxious to do something different than I was too, because the grind of getting on a sleeper and finding people in the trains just jammed and crowded and no hotel rooms, and all were getting $8 a day per diem, so I was losing money every time I turned around. And at the end of my tour, I had, I don't know, $4,000 or $5,000 that took off from my income tax that I had never, that I was out of pocket. So I never got paid for that. I got about a third of it, maybe more than a third, I guess, back. But there was no way around that. I mean, you go to Los Angeles on a trip and your hotel room be $8. So you didn't have anything to eat out. One thing we could do, though, we could ride our transportation anywhere we wanted to. And I've heard of guys would write out a berth because they couldn't find a room in a hotel, and go to bed and take the train into New York at night and wake up in the morning. They would take the train. I'd take the train to New York wide awake, and then they could go over and get on a berth and come back on the Erie. And they just write out a ticket to New York, and then they write out a ticket on the Erie back to Washington on the 102 train, which they could board at 10 o'clock and go to bed.
That was their hotel room.
That was their hotel room. But I've had cases where I had a room in the Continental Hotel one time, and the clerk knew me from coming there quite a lot, and he'd call up and say, there's a guy down here that needs a room badly. Do you mind if I send him up? I said, well, you can vouch for the guy, all right. So I'd have strangers sleeping with me. And everybody did this during the war. It was really a terrible jam down there. Mm. Well, aside from all that stuff, I guess I haven't... I was fairly active in the ACS for quite a time. That goes back to the 1930s, and I guess I'm emeritus 50 years from the ACS, and the AAAS also through the Gordon connection.
You were Phi Beta Kappa, was that at Chicago?
Yeah, that was at Chicago, yeah.
That's an undergraduate? Undergraduate,
yeah. And, of course, Sigma Psi, I've had a little thing going with them in recent years. I never was an active member except in RISA, the Research Organization of America, whatever it was, for a while. But we had a very active section in the North Jersey section, where we had very interesting meetings, very active meetings.
Well, is there anything else that we should talk about that we've overlooked at this point?
I think we probably said more than we need to.
No, and we'll make sure we haven't left something out.
Well, there's lots of things you can take you off on tangents, I suppose, but... I think we probably covered nearly everything that we...
Okay. Well, then I'd like to thank you very much for your time and...
Well, I'm sure you're welcome. I hope that some of the stuff will be of use to you.
It certainly will be.
You will have a successful outcome.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing this and writing this.
Okay.
Thank you again very much, Dr.
Thanks, Jim.